This week's episode is sponsored by the podcast, Scary Time. Prepare yourself for the scariest, creepiest, and most terrifying stories and conversations, from the cursed tale of Griffith Park to Salem and the Bell Witch. There's something to get everybody's heart racing. Each weekly episode is hosted by a selection of the best content creators, and they cover cases such as paranormal hauntings, aliens, creepy places, strange phenomena, and everything in between. So wrap yourself up tight in bed, make sure your door is locked, and subscribe to Scary Time across all podcast platforms. The link is in my show notes. Welcome to Morbidology. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, Mysteries Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join Morbidology on Patreon for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, exclusive merch, ad-free and early release episodes, and much more. When hatred goes unchecked, it can lead to a disaster. And tragically, far too often, violent words lead to violent actions. On a busy MAX train in Portland, Oregon in 2017, a man unleashed a racist and xenophobic attack mainly aimed at a Muslim and African-American teenager. The perpetrator had been a member of the alt-right movement, and had made blatant indications in his words and in his actions that he was radicalized. A number of onlookers would come to the girl's aid, but then things took a deadly turn. A turn that would result in innocent people paying the ultimate price. At around 4:30 p.m. on the 26th of May, 2017, police in Portland, Oregon, responded to the Hollywood Transit Center, located near Northeast 42nd Avenue and Halsey Street. They had received reports that a man on a MAX train had been yelling hate speech before stabbing three people who had attempted to intervene. When they arrived at the scene, two men were found to be suffering from extremely traumatic injuries that have been inflicted with some kind of knife. Paramedics were on scene and performed life-saving measures. Tragically, however, one man was pronounced dead at the scene, while the second one was rushed to hospital, where he was also pronounced dead shortly after arriving. A third man had been stabbed during the frenzied attack and was being treated for injuries that were described as non-life-threatening, but serious. That afternoon, the two murder victims would be identified as 53-year-old Ricky John Best of Happy Valley and 23-year-old Talishan Namkai Mitch of Southeast Portland. The third man who was stabbed in the attack was identified as 21-year-old Micah Fletcher of Southeast Portland. The attacker would be identified as 35-year-old Jeremy Joseph Christian of North Portland. Jeremy had been arrested shortly after the attack unfolded. With the victims identified and the perpetrator behind bars, it was now time for investigators to try and piece together a timeline of events leading up to the murders, and to try and determine what exactly had taken place. While it wasn't rush hour as the attack had unfolded on the MAX train, it was still very busy for that time of day, and there wasn't a lack of witnesses. In fact, the entire ordeal had been witnessed by numerous people. According to witnesses, Jeremy had been spewing racist and xenophobic remarks at two teenage girls, Destiny Mangum and Walia Muhammad, one of whom had been wearing a hijab. Jeremy had said that all Muslims should die and that they had been killing Christians for years. He He also told them he didn't care if they were in ISIS, as he swigged from a bottle of sangria. Destiny would state, "He told us that we should go back to Saudi Arabia, and he told us we shouldn't be here, to get out of his country. He was just telling us that we basically weren't anything, and that we should kill ourselves." That day marked the beginning of Ramadan, the holiest time of the year for Muslims. A lot of the vitriol that he was shouting on the train was anti-Muslim, but it wasn't exclusive to that. Jeremy was also shouting about male circumcision and Jews, as well as free speech. As a matter of fact, the entire ordeal had been captured on the security cameras from inside the train, and a number of passengers had recorded it as well. According to one witness, Arsenia Bertel, Jeremy was just cursing, and so the passengers were getting nervous, so the girls moved to our area. As Jeremy continued with his racist and xenophobic diatribe, other people on the train attempted to calm him down and de-escalate the situation, telling him to stop and to get off the train. Three of those people were Ricky, Talishan and Micah, who were the three people standing closest to Jeremy. At one point, Jeremy started to yell that he was in America, that this was a free country and he could do whatever he liked. According to witnesses, one of the men stated, "You can't get on like that. They're just little girls." Jeremy stood up and moved towards the three men and the other passengers. He pushed Talishan as he yelled at him to do something. It was at this moment that Micah stood up. Jeremy responded by pushing Micah and pulling out a knife. Micah pushed Jeremy back. He responded by stating, "Hit me again," to which Micah responded by shouting at him to get off the train, which you can hear in the next clip. The three men were trying to keep Jeremy away from themselves and away from the other passengers. By this point, it was evident that Jeremy was looking for violence. He then swung the knife in one motion and stabbed Micah in the left side of the neck. He then turned to Talishan and stabbed him in the left rear scalp, his left forehead, and in the left side of his neck. At this moment, Ricky stood up from his seat, and he too was stabbed in the right side of the neck, his left cheek, and on the left side of his neck. As Jeremy fled from the train, Micah managed to get up and move on to the platform. He was bleeding very heavily from a large neck wound. You can hear him in the following clip pleading for help. Marcus Knipe, who was on the train platform, helped to calm Micah down. He told him to sit on the ground and relax while other onlookers gave him a cloth to compress his neck while they waited for paramedics to arrive. As Marcus said, "I happened to be in the right place at the right time." Marcus called Mika's mother from the platform and informed her of what had happened. However, he didn't inform her that Micah had been stabbed in the neck. Instead, he told her that she had been stabbed in the arm. As onlookers were attempting to administer first aid to Micah, Jeremy had fled from the scene. A number of witnesses who had been on the Max train followed him to make sure that he wouldn't get away. Jeremy was still carrying the knife he had just murdered two men with, and these brave citizens put their own lives at risk in pursuing him. At one point, he turned to the man who had been following him and threatened them with the knife, calling them snitches. Jeremy was caught near the Providence-Portland Medical Center and was arrested. Before being arrested, he had waved the knife around and said that he was going to come at the responding officers. To onlookers, it looked as though Jeremy was trying to entice the responding officers to shoot him, but eight managed to corner him and handcuff him. From the back of the police car, Jeremy continued on his rant. He said that he just stabbed a bunch of motherfuckers in the neck, before stating, "Get stabbed in the neck if you hate free speech. I can die in prison a happy man. I stabbed the two motherfuckers in the neck, and I'm happy now. I'm happy now, I can rest easy." While still in the back seat of the police car, Jeremy said he hoped his victims died. He would be booked on charges of aggravated murder, attempted murder, intimidation and felony possession of a restricted weapon. Victim, 53-year-old Ricky John, was an Army veteran and a married father of four. His wife was a Vietnamese stay-at-home mother. He had grown up in Oregon and had met his wife at Portland Community College. Afterwards, Jeremy joined the Army and had served in both Iraq and Afghanistan. He served in the Army for 23 years, before leaving in 2012. He was a one-time candidate for Clackamas County Commissioner, and he was very well liked in his place of employment, as a technician for the City Bureau of Development Services. His supervisor, Karen Perkins, said, "He was always the first person you would go to for help." Ricky was said to be the kind of person who would always step in and help anybody ever in need. 23-year-old Talishan Namkai Minch was a Reed College graduate from Ashland. He was known as Tilly by his loved ones, and he grew up with six siblings and his mother. He graduated with a degree from economics in 2016, and then found a job with the Cadmus Group, which was a local consulting firm, where the president, Ian Klein, described him as bright, dedicated, and kind-hearted, as well as a great friend to many in the business. Following his murder, Ian would state that his life had been lost in an act of selfless bravery, which represented the best of what everybody hoped to be. Talishan had just recently purchased his first home in southeast Portland, and he had a girlfriend who he planned on marrying and starting a family with. Those who knew Talishan said that they were heartbroken by his death, but said that they weren't surprised that he had died while trying to help somebody else. His friend Jimmy said that he was the kind of guy who made you believe that you could be bigger than yourself. He had a close-knit group of friends, many of whom had grown up in Ashland together, and then stayed good friends after they all went their separate ways. They said that Talishan would always be there for them if ever they were feeling down or struggling with any personal issues. Talishan made it his mission to reach out and try and help in any way possible. Another friend, Christopher Land, said, "If he knew he was going to die, he still would have done what he did." While in college, Talishan had taken an introduction to Islam class, and he stood out to his professor, Kambit Ghani Basiri, who said that he was always trying to understand the world from someone else's perspective. He said that Talishan was considerate of other students' participation, and if somebody wasn't confident in a comment that they had made, Talishan always made sure to back them up and try to ensure that they felt confident. His professor said, "He's just the kind of person, if he saw somebody being mistreated, he would have spoken up." In a statement to the media, Talesian's family said that he had lived a joyous and full life. They said, "His enthusiasm was infectious. We lost him in a senseless act that brought close to home the insidious rift of prejudice and intolerance that is too familiar, too common." According to Rachel Macy, who had stayed by Talesian's side while waiting for paramedics to arrive, his final words were, "Tell everyone on this train, I love them." 21-year-old Micah Fletcher would be rushed to hospital with a wound to the neck. He was in stable condition by that night after a two-hour surgery, in which surgeons removed bone fragments from his throat. He had been slashed from the left side of the neck, and the knife had punctured his neck and was just millimetres away from his jugular vein. He had been taking the train that afternoon from classes at Portland State University to his job at a pizza shop. His girlfriend Miranda Helm would tell the Oregonian that she was more worried about his mental state than his physical state. She said, "It's hard to watch two people die right next to you, knowing that you were involved in the attack and that these two people died and you made it." Micah was well established in the poetry community and was known for his passion for social justice. Back in 2013, he had won a poetry competition with a poem condemning prejudices faced by Muslims. It read in part, "When two towering trees of wrought iron and glass and cement are brought down to their knees, we let it leave an ugly footprint on America that hasn't disappeared in 12 years. As in one third of the amount of civilians killed by drones in the Middle East per one terrorist caught in the crossfire." At 10:15 p.m. on the night after the attack, Micah had posted a photograph of himself in the hospital. A red tube could be seen going from his throat down to his chest, while a red slash could be seen across his neck. He captioned the photograph, "I am alive. I spat in the eye of hate and lived. This is what we must do for one another. We must live for one another. We must fight for one mother. We must die in the name of freedom if we have to. Luckily, it's not my turn today." As news of the senseless and disturbing murders wended throughout Portland and the surrounding area, Commissioner Chloe Udalle, who was standing in for Mayor Ted Wheeler, who was currently on a flight, released a statement which read in part, "The city of Portland has a heavy heart right now, and our thoughts and prayers go to the families and friends of the deceased and the injured. This is an especially sad and disturbing incident. People lost their lives or were injured because they stood up to hate. We need to offer our heartfelt support to the two women and others who were targeted. The courage of the people that stood up for them is a reminder that as a city we need to stand together to denounce hate. Thank you to the courageous witnesses who helped police locate the suspect before more people were hurt. Thank you to the first responders and medical personnel who arrived quickly to administer aid. And thank you to the police for apprehending the suspect." When Mayor Ted Wheeler got off his flight, he himself offered a statement and called the three men heroes for doing the right thing and standing up for strangers against hatred. He said that their actions were selfless and brave and should serve as an example and an inspiration to everybody. The community would really come together to offer support for the victims and their loved ones. In less than 24 hours, a GoFundMe set up to provide financial support for the victims and their families would reach more than $150,000. The description on the GoFundMe read, "They are heroes, yet their families are not only going to be faced with the pain of losing people they love, but with financial hardships from their passings." The attack and the events leading up to it would prompt a lot of soul searching within Portland, a city which prides itself on its tolerance and its liberal views. While it is one of the nation's most socially liberal regions, it also has a long and violent history of white supremacy and other racist activities. At one point in history, Portland was called the skinhead capital of the country, and racism really had quite deep roots in Oregon. In fact, in the 1930s, the pro-Nazi German-American Bund had an active bundlet where the members were indoctrinated in notions of anti-Semitic grievance, as well as Aryan superiority. The attack on the train had led to a lot of people wondering, would I be willing to die to defend a stranger and to put my body on the line to stop white supremacy-filled acts of violence? Mayor Wheeler would ask for the Trump Free Speech Rally, scheduled for the 4th of June, to be cancelled, as well as a rally which targeted Sharia law on the 10th of June, because he feared that it could cause unrest. He stated, these kinds of rallies are typically people who come from elsewhere and hold rallies here because we are a deep blue city. They are intending to be provocative. A makeshift memorial was set up at Hollywood Transit Centre. People left flowers, letters of condolences and other small trinkets and gifts at the centre of Northeast Halsey Street and 42nd Avenue. Just the day after the attack, around 1,000 people gathered around the memorial for a vigil. A microphone was passed around the crowd as people praised Ricky, Talishan and Mika and condemned Jeremy. The three men were recollected as heroes, as those in attendance said that they hoped everybody could stand up to hate the way that they had done. Ellie Eaton stated, we're learning about them as human beings who stood up and did the right thing. They didn't have capes, they were just human beings that we all have the capacity to be like. The family members of the victims were in attendance, and Talishan's mother, Asha Deliverance, thanked everybody for attending and told them that they had all gathered there for love. A vigil would also be held at the Muslim Educational Trust as the first day of Ramadan fasting came to an end. Mayor Wheeler told the packed auditorium that the three men had given him hope. Hope that there are still people in Oregon who would stand up for the right thing, regardless of the consequences. Leaders of the Muslim community would state that they were thankful for the men who had stood up against hatred and very likely saved the lives of two teenage girls who were being abused by Jeremy. Wajdi Syed, the president and co-founder of the Muslim Educational Trust, thanked the many from outside the faith who came to the vigil and celebration. Haris Savar, who is the Ahmadiyya Muslim community leader, said that the attack had created safety concerns for the Muslim community, especially for women, and there was fear that Jeremy's actions could inspire copycats. Towards the end of the vigil, it was also announced that they had already raised $50,000 towards the goal of $60,000 to help support the victims and their families. Investigators announced that they would be looking into the extremist ideology of Jeremy and revealed that he did not have any known mental health history and was not flagged as a criminal gang member. He did, however, have a criminal record. He was convicted of robbery, kidnapping and a weapons charge back in 2002. He had ridden to a convenience store on his bike and handcuffed the shopkeeper while he stole money and cigarettes. When police managed to track him down, he aimed the gun at himself, allegedly in a suicide attempt, but he was shot and injured by police. He'd be sentenced to just over 7 years in prison after he managed to strike a plea deal that eliminated coercion and weapons charges. Then in 2010, he was arrested on charges of being a felon in possession of a firearm and theft, and would be sentenced to time served plus 3 years of supervised release. He would violate the terms of his release several times, such as in August of 2012, when he tested positive in a urine test for spice, which is synthetic marijuana. He had to take the urine test after he failed to attend treatment and would agree to go to a residential reentry center, but then violate supervision. He would be resentenced to another 9 months. I've recently become obsessed with Foreo and they've sponsored this episode. Foreo exists to reinvent beauty and wellness by offering innovative devices that install confidence and improve your skin. I've been using the Luna 3, which features thin touch points for cleansing your face. I've also been using the UFO Mini, which is a 90-second face treatment utilizing hyper-infusion technology. It leaves my skin glowing and radiant in just 90 seconds. I have quite sensitive skin and Foreo genuinely leaves my skin feeling amazing. I've also been using the massage function on Luna 3, which directs lower frequency pulsations to wrinkle-prone areas, and smooths the appearance of fine lines. I've been doing this for a couple of weeks now and already see a difference in the look and feel of my skin. Foreo are offering Morbidology listeners an Amazon bundle, which includes the Luna 3, the UFO Mini, and Call It a Night UFO activated mask. The set is valued at $307.99 and retails on Amazon at $249. But with the code MORBID50, you can get it for $199. There are two other bundles, but that's the one I've got. It's been a tough year and a half for all of us, and it's about time we deserve to have that moment of pampering zen. I swear by their products now and use them every single day. Just click the link in my show notes to the Amazon bundles, or go to Foreo's Amazon shop and click the bundles tab and use code MORBID50 for 35% off. Like many of you, I'm hoping that this summer we can go back to normal. You know, go and see our friends, go to the cinema, hang out in a bar. If you want it to feel like summertime already and keep yourself preoccupied while we wait for things to return to normal, then I think you should download Best Fiends. It's been keeping me busy during the past while, and it's a great game filled with cute characters, which is a refreshing break from true crime writing. They've even sponsored this episode of Morbidology. With Best Fiends, the fun never ends. There's thousands of levels and tons of characters. I'm on level 287, but there's new puzzles to solve each and every day. It's one of those games where 30 minutes really feels like 30 seconds. Best Fiends is super easy to follow and it's fun to play, making it the perfect game for both adults and children. It's a casual game that won't stress you out, and it's very easy to pass the time with. I find myself playing it before bed and when I'm out walking my dog. Download Best Fiends for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends. While Jeremy was transient, he essentially still lived at home with his parents, in the northern outskirts of Portland. It was an area that had been gentrifying in the more recent years, because it was one of the only affordable sections within the city. He lived in a very diverse neighbourhood, with neighbours of all races, creeds, and sexual orientations. According to neighbours, the Christian family had lived there for around 4 decades. They said that Jeremy's parents were very quiet but good people, and his father was always there to offer a helping hand. As it would transpire, Jeremy had been a bubbling pot of hatred for quite some time, and was a very vocal participant in the alt-right. During a free speech rally that was held after the 82nd Avenue of Roses parade was cancelled, he had showed up to a city park armed with a baseball bat and had shouted racial slurs along with some of his reprehensible friends, who clearly shared the same hatred. He was captured on video wrapped in an American flag, giving Nazi salutes and repeatedly shouting that all Muslims should die. He was also captured on video threatening to shoot anybody who attempted to disarm him.
Take your mask off and debate why I'm here. This is my soapbox. Portland, Oregon, the Northwest. We got Supreme Court rulings for our freedom of speech since the 50s and 60s in the Northwest. I don't care if you say you're a patriot and you say I can't come in your punk group. Take your mask off, mister. Don't tread on me. Don't be like these faceless punk Antifa, Jeremy Christian on Facebook.
I think they took a, I'm not sure if they
Jeremiah Christian is my Christian name. You don't want to know my real name. I am just the dude that promoted shooting anyone that tried to disarm me. Get the back to whatever state you came from, Antifa. Go back.
Kat Devalia, who was among the counter-protesters, said that he had shown up partway through the event and came marching up to the counter-demonstrator crowd, waving a baseball bat by his side. Jeremy's Facebook page also revealed a very disturbing obsession with extremely far-right themes. He had publicly idolized Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City bomber, referring to him as a true patriot, and had posted, "World War III is just fine with me." He also posted memes attacking anti-fascist protesters, and had posted a status which read, "Looking for a couple guys or gals down to unmask anyone wearing a mask at the upcoming free speech march." Jeremy was also obsessed with neo-Nazism and openly posted material relating to it. On the 9th of May, he claimed to challenge Ben Ferencz, who was the chief prosecutor during the Nuremberg trials. He wrote, "I will defend the Nazis," followed by "Hail Vinland, Hail Victory," which was a combination of a catchphrase used at a post-election rally by Richard Spencer with the far-right concept of Vinland. Vinland refers to an area in eastern Canada that Leif Erikson allegedly settled from Iceland. Jim Burley, author of Fascism Today, explained that the far-right movement used this as a way to assert that white nationalists are Vikings in a new land, continuing the ancient battle for preservation of their people. Jeremy had even uploaded a photograph of Adolf Hitler in an album, which he had titled Good Stuff. Jeremy had a number of posts about male circumcision as well, and had written, "I want a job in Norway cutting off the heads of people that circumcise babies." And he had posted articles about Norway attempting to ban male circumcision. Jeremy's Facebook indicated very shifting political views, and he would quite frequently contradict himself. It's that confusion and fuzziness that is a hallmark of extremism. He had posted about wanting Bernie Sanders to be president, writing, "He voiced my heart and mind," and he openly lambasted Hillary Clinton, and even wrote that it was his life's ambition to kill her. In January, he had posted, "Donald Trump is the next Hitler. I am joining his SS to put an end to monotheist question. All Zionist Jews, all Christians who do not follow Christ's teaching of love, charity and forgiveness, and all jihadi Muslims are going to Madagascar, or the ovens, /FEMA camps. Does this make me a fascist?" In another bizarre post, he wrote, "The only form of abortion I support is the old-fashioned method that doesn't cost taxpayers money. Daddy kicks mommy in the stomach." Jeremy also seemingly supported Standing Rock and rallied against the military-industrial complex, and he had posted a photograph of a black Santa Claus with the caption, "Share this picture of black Santa because it will piss off a racist asshole." With the investigation underway, Lauren Cannon, special agent in charge of the Portland FBI office, would state that it was too early to say whether the attack was an act of domestic terrorism or a federal hate crime. Within 48 hours of the attack, the GoFundMe would reach more than $300,000, and another fundraiser on LaunchGood would reach $260,000. There would also be a GoFundMe set up for Micah, which reached $100,000 in the first 48 hours, and another for Destiny and Walia, the two girls who Jeremy had directed his initial hatred towards. The attack had really shaken Portland and led to immediate action. While the Muslim community had hoped to raise $60,000 for the victims and their loved ones, within 48 hours they would reach over $200,000. The campaign had been led by the Muslim Educational Trust and Celebrate Mercy, which is a non-profit which aims to counter misinformation about Islam. Their fundraising page read, "We wish to respond to hate with love, to evil with good, as our faith instructs us, and send a powerful message of compassion through action. Our Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, said, 'Have mercy to those on earth, and the one in heaven, God, will have mercy upon you.'" Ultimately, all of the fundraising pages would reach well over $1 million. Meanwhile, cell phone footage would be released from the day before the murders. It had captured Jeremy going on a racist tirade on another Max train. In the video, which was captured by an onlooker, Jeremy ranted about Muslims, Christians and Jews, and at one point had even threatened to stab the driver of the train.
"Oh, it's like we got a Christian or Muslim bus driver, I'll stab you too. Move forward. Move forward, Max driver.
I'm about to stab some.
Call the police, I dare you."
He said that he was a neo-Nazi and was looking to recruit other people. He went on to state he hated black people as well as Mexican people and Japanese people, adding that he hated anybody who wasn't a Christian like he was, and that this was his country. Later that night, on another Max train, he turned on Demetria Hester, who was a 42-year-old black woman heading home from her sous chef job. He told her that she had no right to be there and that she needed to go back to her own country. Demetria would later say that she felt as though she was living in the 1920s during her encounter with Jeremy. She asked Jeremy to lower his voice because nobody on the train wanted to hear him threaten and terrorize other people. Jeremy responded by telling Demetria that he built America and that because she was black, she had no right to be there. He then threatened to kill all Muslims, Jews, and black people. Demetria had gotten off the train at the Rose Quarter station, and Jeremy followed her. By this point, the train operator had contacted the Max Command Centre, and a TriMet supervisor was sent to meet the train. At the Rose Quarter station, Jeremy shouted that if anybody wanted to call the police, he wasn't scared to go to prison. He shouted, "I will kill anyone who stands in my way, because I have a right to do this." Jeremy threw a Gatorade bottle at Demetria and it hit her in the right eye. Demetria grabbed a mace bottle, which was in her purse, and sprayed Jeremy in the face. When police arrived at the scene, Demetria identified Jeremy as the man who had attacked her. They wasted time asking Demetria questions, while Jeremy was literally standing behind her, and she kept repeating that he was the man who had attacked her. When police finally got around to trying to interview Jeremy, he was gone. Demetria later recalled that she said to the police officer, "How am I supposed to feel protected when we just watched him walk away? And you're arguing with me about who he is." Given the fact that less than 24 hours later, Jeremy would stab three people on another Max train, the footage is very chilling, knowing just what he was capable of. Jeremy would briefly appear in court the following day, during which he made several outbursts.
"Free speech or die, Portland, you got no safe place. This is America. Get out if you don't like free speech. Death to the enemies of America. Leave this country if you hate our freedom. Death to Antifa. You call it terrorism, I call it patriotism. You hear me? Die."
He didn't enter a plea and was told to return to court on the 7th of June. He was appointed a public defender, and Lane Borg, who was head of the local public defender's agency, said that the office was saddened by the tragedy, but urged people to let the justice system take its course. On the same day as Jeremy appeared in court, Micah was released from hospital. In an emotional interview with KPTV News, Destiny, who is one of the young girls who was one of the targets of Jeremy's rants on the train, expressed gratitude for the strangers who had intervened. She said, "I just want to say thank you to the people who put their life on the line for me, because they didn't even know me, and they lost their lives because of me and my friend and the way we looked." She said that she wanted to thank them and their families, because if it wasn't for them, she and her friend could potentially be dead. In the beginning of June, Jeremy's family would issue a public statement of condolences. It read, "We offer our deepest sympathies to the families of the deceased, to the young women harassed, and to everyone who tried to protect these young women. We cannot begin to understand this senseless act. We abhor violence, racism, and bigotry. We are praying for healing for everyone affected by the horrible actions of our son." Meanwhile, Micah would meet with Destiny, who he had stood up to protect. Her mother would post photographs on her Facebook account and refer to Micah as one of the angels that had saved her daughter's life. Micah would take to his own Facebook page to state that he was worried that while he was being lionized, Destiny and Walia were being largely forgotten. He asked people to remember that they too were hurt that day. While not physically, they had been verbally abused and then traumatized by the attack. He thanked everybody for their support but said he feared that long-standing local attitudes and biases caused aid to flow more freely to him than to the two girls. He said, "We in Portland have this weird tendency to continue patterns that we've done forever. And one of them is this same old, just to put it bluntly, white savior complex. Suffice to say, I think it's immensely, immensely morally wrong and irresponsible how much money we have gotten, as opposed to how much support, money, love, kindness that has been given to that little girl. Early in June, it would tragically be revealed that as Ricky was taking his last breaths on the train after being stabbed, somebody had robbed him and stole his wedding ring and backpack. On the 3rd of June, it would be announced that 51-year-old homeless man George Shigeni was arrested and charged with second-degree theft, tampering with physical evidence and second-degree abuse of a corpse. He had exploited the chaotic situation to steal from a dying man who had just put his own life on the line for a stranger. He would ultimately be sentenced to 13 months in prison and a drug treatment program. He was addicted to heroin, and he apologised to Ricky's family before receiving his sentence. The following day, an alt-right rally went ahead in Portland despite the mayor requesting it be cancelled. It ended in police using stun grenades and tear gas against counter-protesters. The police had started to move the counter-protesters away from Chapman Square, which was located just across the road from the rally. Since the rally had gone ahead, there was a number of counter-protests surrounding the rally. Simab Hussein from the Oregon Council on Islamic Relations said that he was pleased to see how many people showed up to counter the rally. He said, "It's just the same ball of yarn. The hate, the prejudice, the violence. It finds a new victim. If it's not Muslims, it's immigrants." Later that night, a Muslim community center would hold a memorial for Talishan and Ricky. Mike would be in attendance and would speak to the crowd. He said, "I do believe that after these events, I have a purpose. So let me be clear. It is our time to do something about this." Several hundred people had shown up for the memorial, including law enforcement and politicians. Micah would call on preachers, pastors, and rabbis to integrate anti-racist ideology into their services. Is there something interfering with your happiness, or are you apprehensive about reaching out for help? BetterHelp is here to help you and their today's sponsor of Morbidology. BetterHelp is not self-help, it's professional counseling available to you online or over the phone. BetterHelp is more affordable and accessible than traditional offline counseling, and they offer financial aid. Sadly, sometimes traditional offline counseling is not locally available for everybody, but BetterHelp is available for clients worldwide. They have licensed professional counselors specializing in a broad variety of areas, including depression, sleeping, self-esteem, grief, and much more. Everything you share with your counselor is confidential and they are matched to your specific needs. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/morbidology. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp.com/morbidology. I've recently joined the new podcast app, Vodacast, and they've even sponsored this episode of Morbidology. Vodacast is a podcast app, but what sets it apart from other podcast apps is that they provide deeper digital stories. For example, you could be listening to this episode on Vodacast and immerse yourself in some bonus content, such as photographs related to the case, including photographs of the victim and photographs of the criminal investigation, as well as links to newspaper articles and much more. On Vodacast, not only can you listen to your favourite podcasts, but those episodes can come alive with supplemental digital content paired with that episode. With Vodacast, everything you want to know about that specific episode is right there on your fingertips. I know for me personally, when I finish an episode, I'll always go on Google Image the people involved in the episode and read more about the case. But with Vodacast, you don't need to do that. So click the link in my show notes or just search for Vodacast on the App Store and check it out today. Meanwhile, Ricky was laid to rest. His funeral was held at Christ the King Catholic Church. Hundreds of people, including loved ones, acquaintances, and strangers, would file into the church to pay their final respects to your hero. His family had requested that there be no cameras inside the church. They wore white headbands, which was a symbol of mourning and honour in Vietnamese tradition. The funeral was led by Reverend Rick Paparini, who called Ricky a martyr, and said that while he was shocked by the tragedy, he was not shocked by Ricky's actions. He said, "No one has a greater love than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends." His son, Eric, provided a brief eulogy. He said, "It didn't matter much about race, ethnicity, religion. He just wanted to help whoever was in need. He was a hero way before his sacrifice on the Max." Eric then read out a letter from his grandfather, who didn't speak English. He called Ricky a pillar. In an extremely powerful moment of multiculturalism, a member of the Islamic faith read aloud an Islamic prayer. Haris Savar, of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, said he wished he could thank Ricky in the flesh, thank him for being the father and human that he strived to be. He cited the Quran, which said if you kill one, it's as if you have killed all, and if you save a life, it's as if you have saved all. Following the service, hundreds of people lined the route of the procession, from the church to the Willametta National Cemetery, where Ricky was to be laid to rest with a full military honour. The following day, a grand jury would return a 15-count indictment against Jeremy, including two charges of aggravated murder, one count of attempted aggravated murder, one count of first-degree assault, one count of second-degree assault, five counts of unlawful use of a weapon, and three counts of second-degree intimidation, and two counts of menacing. Four of those charges stemmed from the harassment case on a Max train the day before the murders, which I briefly spoke about earlier in this episode. It would be confirmed that Jeremy was also being investigated for the attack on Demetria the previous day. Another one of the charges related to Jeremy threatening to use the knife against another passenger who was on the Max train when the stabbings had occurred. Sean Ford had attempted to calm Jeremy down as he made his rant towards the two teenage girls. He appeared in court the following day. Mika sat at the front row of the courtroom. During his brief court appearance, Jeremy once again had an outburst.
"Not guilty of anything but defending myself against violent aggression by Michael Fletcher."
It was kind of ironic that he was claiming self-defense, considering the fact the entire event on the Max train had been recorded. Jeremy was the one who was carrying a knife. Jeremy was the one who went on a bigoted rant aimed at two teenage girls. Jeremy was the one who threatened to stab people. Jeremy was the one who launched the attack and started it by pushing deletion. Micah simply responded by pushing him back in a bid to defend himself and the other passengers. Deletion's funeral was scheduled for the 7th of June. It began at Lithia Park, where there was a picnic followed by music and memorial offerings. Lithia Park was just a block away from the house where Deletion had grown up. In announcing the funeral, his mother, Asha, said, "Bring blankets, food, and lots of love. No alcohol, please. And share your fondest memories of Deletion among each other against a gentle backdrop of angelic piano music." Many people in attendance spoke of Deletion's love of poetry, as well as his goofy sense of humour. They spoke of the extension of love that he seemed to share with every single person he met in his life. Before the crowd, his mother Asha said, "Of course I'm proud of him, and I would have probably spanked him if he didn't take care of things on that train, because I would expect that of any man." She said that the actions of her son and the others on the train that day sent out a message to the world that love can beat hatred. Deletion's friend, Alex Landry, said, "Tilly cared about all of us. We were all on that train. He was remembered as smart, empathetic, and courageous. Loved ones fondly recalled how he loved reading philosophy books and was always on a mission. He loved people, nature, and the game Dungeons and Dragons." Asha said to the crowd, "Don't think my son died in vain. I promise you, he did not." During the service, Asha would be presented with a letter of gratitude from members of the Muslim community, who thanked her for raising a strong and righteous man, while Ashland Mayor John Stromberg presented the family with a governor's flag of honour. From the park, they moved to Jackson Wellsprings for a slideshow, followed by a no-host dinner provided by Wellsprings. The following week, Reed College would establish a scholarship in Talesian's name, while the Roseland Theatre in downtown Portland announced that they would be hosting a benefit concert for Destiny and Walia. It was also announced that Legacy Health would waive all medical costs for Micah, who said that he was extremely grateful because he and his family would have struggled to pay for the surgery and the hospital stay. The City of Portland also announced that they would pay insurance for 3 years for Ricky's family. Ricky had been employed by the city, and his death left his family in need of health insurance coverage. The city stated that they would pay up to $77,000 for the family's insurance. In October, TriMet would announce that they were planning two memorials in honour of Talesian and Ricky. One would be permanent and one would be temporary. Public Information Officer Roberta Alstadt said that the memorials would also honour Micah, as well as Destiny and Walia. The first tribute would be a large commemorative plaque that was going to be placed in the Hollywood Transit Centre permanently. It was designed by John Larson and was going to be 4 feet by 6 feet and made of porcelain enamel on steel. It would feature text mixed with images of images created by friends, family and strangers in the wake of the attack. The second tribute would be a mural consisting of messages that were written by the community at the makeshift memorial. An artist would paint some of those original notes. The following month, Jeremy would appear in court for a bail hearing. During the court appearance, graphic details of the attack were read aloud. Detective Michelle Michaels testified that Jeremy had inflicted 11 stab wounds in just 11 seconds. It would also be revealed that Jeremy explained that he was on what he called autopilot during the attack and allegedly wasn't aware of his actions until he heard the other passengers yelling that he was killing people. The judge would deny Jeremy bail, and it would later be announced that Jeremy would be standing trial in June of 2019. The judge decided on a later date because of how complex the case was. In March of 2018, the mural memorializing the victims of the MAX train attack was unveiled. Sarah Farhat was the artist, and her work was painted on concrete walls at the Hollywood Transit Centre. She had used bright orange, purple and deep blues, alongside budding Western peonies. She also painted excerpts from a poem, which was translated into 8 languages. The mural wasn't yet finished, and Sarah proposed painting the inside wall with a train car and the Hamsa hand, which is an ancient symbol of protection, commonly used in North Africa as well as the Middle East. She said that she and her team were hoping to have it fully completed by the end of the year. Then on the 1 year anniversary in May, a memorial was held at the Hollywood Transit Centre. It was called the Commemoration of Heroism and Community. A lot of people who attended the memorial had been on the MAX train that day. Some said that they still struggled to step on a MAX train, while others said they felt tremendous survivor's guilt. The Muslim Centre in Teagard also held an interfaith service to mark the sombre anniversary. The Muslim Educational Trust Centre had raised over $600,000 for the victims of the attack. At 4:30 p.m. that day, which was the time the attack had unfolded a year beforehand, the Buddhist Dionysian Temple in Portland rang 5 times to honour Talesian, Ricky, Micah, Destiny and Walia. In August, it was announced that the families of Ricky and Talesian reached an agreement on how to divide the $1.6 million that was raised by supporters in the aftermath. Micah had relinquished his claims to the money, meaning that all of it would be going to Ricky and Talesian's families. In March of 2019, as the trial was fast approaching, Jeremy's defence lawyers filed a motion requesting that the murder trial be moved to another county. Ultimately, the judge would refuse to move the trial, and the pre-trial hearing began in April. By this point, Jeremy's defence team had requested that the trial be pushed back until July. Demetria Hester, who had been attacked by Jeremy the day before the murders, would be in court to try and urge the judge not to postpone the murder trial. As Demetria referred to the MAX train as a senseless hate crime, Jeremy shouted out, "Manufactured." Judge Cheryl Albrecht told Jeremy to be quiet or he would be removed from the courtroom, and he responded by pointing at Demetria and stating, "I don't really care. I'm the victim. You're on video macing me. Liar." He stood up towards Demetria and kept rambling. Two deputies grabbed him as he continued yelling and dragged him out of the courtroom. Outside of court, Demetria said, "He's just expressing himself. That's him, an angry white racist." The judge would agree for the trial to be postponed, and it was postponed until January of 2021. Shortly after the hearing, Talishan and Ricky's families would file a $20 million lawsuit against TriMet and the Portland Police Bureau for failing to arrest and ban Jeremy from the system. The lawsuit accused them of having two opportunities to intervene and save the lives of Talishan and Ricky, including the attacks the day beforehand. TriMet and the Portland Police Bureau would respond and state that they were not to blame for the murders that Jeremy had committed. In October, it would be announced that Jeremy could not be tried for aggravated murder if he were found guilty, which meant that he could not be sentenced to death under a new law that had been passed by the state legislature that year. Under that new law, defendants could only be tried and convicted of aggravated murder if they killed two or more people as an act of organized terrorism, if they intentionally killed a child younger than 14 with premeditation, if they killed another person while in jail or in prison for a previous murder, and if they killed a police, correctional or probation officer. The murder trial finally began towards the end of January 2020. After the jury were seated, Christian walked into the courtroom and stated, "Are you guys ready to smash Portland's fairy tale?" During opening statements, Prosecutor Don Reese detailed the events the night before the murders. He spoke about the attack on Demetria, stating that Jeremy had told her when she knocked on the train operator's door to get help and was ignored, "Fuck you, bitch. I'll rape and kill you." He then spoke about the following day when Jeremy got onto the MAX train. He was swigging from a bottle of sangria and held the Book of Mormon above his head and started ranting. When he turned his attention to Destiny and Walia, they got up and stood behind Sean Ford, who was standing nearby. Sean pressed the help button inside the train, but nobody responded. It was at this moment that Sean, Ricky, Talishan and Micah told Jeremy to get off the train. By this point, Talishan had started to record Jeremy, thinking that he would later need it as evidence of a hate crime against two teenage girls. When Jeremy pushed Talishan, Micah stood up.
"So here's what happens when Micah approaches Jeremy Christian. Jeremy Christian shoves Micah Fletcher back. It's the first physical contact in this incident. Jeremy Christian shoving Micah Fletcher. Micah does not react to this. He doesn't shove back. He doesn't say anything or do anything. But in that moment, and this happens in a split second, and again, during or after that first shove by Jeremy Christian takes his left hand and digs it into the pocket of his baggy shorts. And he pulls out the knife that was concealed there. And then, with his right hand, Jeremy Christian shoves back Talishan. And at that point, having seen that, Micah Fletcher grabs Jeremy Christian by the shirt, and he shoves him back. And he says, 'Get the fuck off, boy. The train is now fully stopped. The doors are open.' And Micah says, 'Get the fuck off.' Jeremy Christian stumbles back. He catches himself, as you can see, on the seats. And in that moment, again, no one sees this, Jeremy Christian transfers that knife from his left hand to his right hand. And when he stands back up, the knife is now firmly in his grip. as he's face to face with Michael Fletcher, who has no idea that Jeremy Christian is armed.
It would be revealed that Micah had actually come into contact with Jeremy at a political rally just a couple of weeks earlier. After Micah stood up, Jeremy pushed him, and Micah pushed him back and shouted at him to get off the train. It was at this moment that Jeremy unleashed the attack.
The witnesses on the train thought he threw a punch. Until they saw the blood spurting out of Michael Fletcher's neck. It happened so fast, as you can see, Talesian is still looking at his phone as the blade goes into Michael Fletcher's neck. And in the next second, Michael Fletcher begins to fall to the ground, and Jeremy Christian shoves the knife into Talesian's neck. Talesian, who, as you can see, is still holding on to that container of food. It happened that fast. Talesian didn't even have his hands up. In the next second, Jeremy Christian stabbed Ricky Best in the back of the neck. At that point, Ricky Best had stood up from his seat and was standing behind Talesian. The evidence will show that Mr. Best really wasn't doing anything. He wasn't saying anything. He wasn't moving. He wasn't waving his arms. He was just standing there when Jeremy Christian grabbed him and put his knife into his neck. Jeremy Christian forced the knife just below Mr. Best's skull, in between his cervical vertebrae, severing an artery there. And that type of wound, the medical pathologist, Dr. Gunson, will tell you no one can survive.
Prosecutor Reese said that the attack happened extremely fast. He referenced a still frame from the video of the attack and said, as you can see, Talesian is still looking at his phone as the blade goes into Micah Fletcher's neck. An instant later, he showed a photograph of the blade entering Talesian's neck. It was at this point that Ricky stood up from his seat, which was beside Talesian. Prosecutor Reese said that as Ricky stood up, Jeremy stabbed him, severing an artery between his cervical vertebrae. Prosecutors revealed that Jeremy had gone on a rant, stating, "That's right. This is a hate crime. I hope they all die. I'm a patriot. I hope everyone I stab dies. You guys are going to have nightmares wondering why I stab people in the neck because I'm a patriot." During opening statements, it would become quite evident that Jeremy's defense was going to be self-defense. Defense attorney Dean Smith, who had stated that Micah was the assaulter and that Jeremy had a reasonable response to a physical assault. He said, "No matter how much Jeremy aggravated people, he had the right to stay on that train, just like everyone else, even if their speech didn't require free speech protection." He countered the prosecution's characterization of the three victims, the starkest of which was when he said that Ricky was wrestling with Jeremy before he was stabbed. The first witness to testify would be Zeta Allen, who was 14 years old at the time of the attack. She said that when Jeremy started ranting about race and religion, she feared for her life because she was black. She held back tears as she said that not a day goes by that she doesn't think about the incident. After the stabbing, she said, "I ran for my life because I didn't know who he was going to come for next." Her testimony would be followed by Walia, who was one of the teenage girls targeted by Jeremy. She was wearing a hijab at the time and told the jury what Jeremy had been shouting.
"Tell me what you remember hearing." remember hearing him say, like, "Well, am I allowed to test?"
If you don't want to, you can. We can think of another way for you to get it across.
He was saying, "But Muslims say go back to Saudi Arabia."
You remember anything else?
He was saying.
Was there any?
Kill yourself.
So you got fuck Muslims, go back to Saudi Arabia, and kill yourself. Those are three things you remember hearing?
Yes.
Was there anybody else on that train that you could see that was wearing a hijab?
No.
Was there any men in traditional Muslim attire?
No.
Were you scared?
Yes.
Why were you scared? This is just someone talking.
I've never experienced any racism towards me or anything that he was saying. I just never experienced it. So this is like my first time, just, you know, someone just coming for me, you know. I was scared. I was scared.
When the train stopped, she, Destiny, and Zeta, who she didn't know, ran from the train because they were afraid that Jeremy was going to turn on them next because of the hateful things that he had been saying. She said that after the attack, she stopped wearing her hijab and suffered PTSD. Destiny would also testify on the first day.
What did you think about what he was saying after you had a chance to process it?
I just feel like it wasn't right. And
did you say it wasn't right?
Yeah.
What wasn't right about it?
The fact that I'm just like trying to just live life and he's just like basically just like telling us that because of our religion or because of our color that we don't deserve to be here and that we don't deserve to live. But I feel like that doesn't make sense. Like, I was born and raised in Portland, Oregon, so, like, I don't feel like I should go somewhere else. I don't feel like I have to go back to where I came from because I'm born here. Like, it just made me feel like, why? Like, there's no reason.
She had recorded portions of the ordeal as well as the moment the stabbing had taken place. She could be heard screaming and crying, "I want to go home," in the moments before the stabbing, as well as more screaming and crying as she saw the men get stabbed. When she was asked if it looked like Jeremy was defending himself, she replied, "No, he wanted an altercation." On the second day of the trial, more witnesses would testify, including Sean Ford.
It was, you know, a whole lot of the rhetoric of Christians kill Muslims, we chop their heads off, we cut their throats, get out of my country, you know, go back to your country. Mostly that.
What did you make of that, of the content of what he was saying? By content, I mean the meaning of the content.
He was right there on the cusp. He hadn't, you know, used the N-word, you know, at that point, but, you know, he hadn't used the N-word at all, and not that I heard, but I was waiting for that. Like, he was moving in that direction where it was more, it was just really, you know, just white supremacist rhetoric, you know.
And the train is moving east as he continues to say these things. Is that
sure.
Correct?
Yes.
All right. And what happens then?
There was a point where when I, you know, kind of like interjected and started, you know, stood in between them, all I was saying to him was like, "Hey, look, man, it's Friday. Ain't nobody trying to hear all of that, you know. Just stop. you know? And so, you know, he told me to F off and, you know, freedom of speech and, you know, it's his country. Get out of his country if I don't like it. And so I remember looking at, like, kind of like touching my hat or something like that, because I always wore a black Marine Corps hat with a Marine Corps emblem on it at the time. And I remember touching my hat and being like, last time I checked, I probably got more right to this country than you do. You know, I've done more for it probably in a year than you've done in your entire life. You know,
did you think that to yourself or did you say that to him?
I'm pretty sure I said that, you know, somewhere in our back and forth. And because he kept, you know, with the get out of my country, you know, freedom of speech. And I remember at one point he jumped up and he jumped up from his seat and he was basically like, do something, right, to me.
He told the courtroom that he tried to de-escalate the situation by taking Jeremy's attention off Destiny and Walia. He said, I didn't think it was directed at them, but then I looked over at Jeremy, and he was yelling directly at them. He was looking right at them when he was yelling about Muslims. The only person wearing anything resembling a Muslim was Walia, but he was looking directly at the girls. He said he moved himself in an effort to shield the teenage girls from Jeremy. He stated, he's talking about Vikings, which is white supremacy rhetoric, in case y'all didn't know. Sean told the courtroom that as Jeremy was ranting, he had pushed the help button at least 20 or so times. He turned to Destiny and Walia and mouthed to them, are you okay? To which they said yes and thanked him.
No, Micah didn't say anything. He just went to grab him and push him off the train. And it looked like the defendant threw a punch. You know, I just remember it looking like he threw a punch. And so, you know, now I'm like, oh, okay. You know, it's definitely escalated. This is probably what the defendant wanted. And so, you know, I'm thinking, you know, it's going to be, you know, just a fight, you know, on the train. And Micah immediately drops, and he drops to a knee, and then he's like, help, and he's grabbing his neck. And I just remember thinking, like, you know, I've never seen, you know, any punch do that to somebody. So I'm looking down at Micah, like, you know, what happened? And I just remember my vantage point, I could see him holding his neck, and I could see blood coming from between his fingers. And at that point, I don't know if people saw the drops or, you know, I'm not sure what other people saw, but I just remember screaming and then everybody just, you know, exiting, you know, the train as fast as they could. But I thought once the defendant had stabbed Micah that he was coming for me. So I was like, okay, I guess this is, you know, what's about to happen. So I stood there for like a split second, but I'm going to his right, my left, because the knife is in his right hand. So, but I'm preparing. But if I go to his right, he has a better, like, you know, I guess, advantage.
Well, so you're a big guy.
Yes.
And you're a tough guy, and you're a Marine.
I'm not a tough guy.
You're not a tough guy. Well, okay, tougher than some. But, sir, at that moment, did you believe that the defendant was going to stick that knife into you?
I believed he was going to try, yes.
Morgan Noonan, a U.S. Army veteran with combat experience, testified next. He, too, was on the MAX train that day and said he recognized Ricky because they commuted around the same time most days. He described Jeremy's rant as offensive and said he was saying things you would say if you wanted to provoke a response, things you wouldn't say if you were trying to be productive. He told the jury, it brought the hairs on my neck up. He was opening up a can of worms. He said it appeared as though Jeremy was baiting to look for a fight so that he could fight back, and said he heard him tell Destiny and Walia he should cut their heads off when they asked him to leave them alone. He testified that he witnessed the stabbing and said he knew that Ricky and Talishan weren't going to survive, and said he believed that they knew it too. He said, a human being knows when they're mortally wounded. You see it in their eyes, their behavior. He said that Ricky died very quickly. Another man on the train, Charles Button, would testify that he had desperately tried to save Ricky's life. He detailed how he was covered in Ricky's blood, as he used a jacket to try and put pressure on the stab wounds to Ricky's neck. He struggled to hold back tears, as he testified.
His eyes were wide, he had his hand on his neck, and he was turning around the corner, and at that point he slipped, let his hand off, and that's when I knew he was injured, because blood was thrown across the car. It was on the window, on the seats, and then he collapsed onto the floor.
What was your emotional state, if you remember, at the time the police officer asked you some questions about what you had seen?
I was very shaky. I was covered in blood from my toes to my knees and my hands, and I was very sad, and trying to figure out what to do next after this. I just felt like I'd let the man down on the train.
Marcus Knipe, who had offered aid to Micah on the train platform, would also take the jury through the chaos that immediately followed the stabbing. He said he had Micah sit down and told him to match his breathing to calm down. He said that when Micah called his mother, he told her to let his employer know that he wasn't going to make it into work. Marcus laughed on the witness stand and said that Micah was worried about being late, not whether he was going to live or die. Meanwhile, police officer Rihanna Kerridge was providing first aid to Talishan. She said he was extremely pale and unresponsive. She said to the courtroom, "That breathing sound is something you hear when someone's about to die." The train operator, Jeffrey Quintana, would also be called to testify during the trial. He said that he had heard some kind of commotion between the Lloyd Center and the Hollywood Transit stop, and had made an announcement asking passengers to keep it down or he would contact police. He said that he didn't hear ringing or see the flashing light when the help button was pushed numerous times by Sean. Edward Johnson, one of the police officers to arrest Jeremy, would testify that as he pointed a taser towards Jeremy, he shouted, "Tase me," and then he called him the N-word. He said he knew that he was speaking to him as opposed to any of the other responding officers, because he was the only black officer. The prosecution would then play out a video of Jeremy from a brief ER visit following his arrest. He used the N-word multiple times and then went on rants similar to the one before the stabbing. He also said, "I'm a Nazi, right? 100% a Nazi, right? Because I was at the 82nd March, marching for free speech." One of the most emotional and highly anticipated moments of the trial came when Micah took to the witness stand. He started his testimony by explaining his autism diagnosis. He said, "I have to focus on a person's face and listen hard to realize whether I'm saying something that's upsetting, strange, or good or kind, because otherwise I end up making people upset or in some way confused without meaning to." He spoke about the free speech rally where he had seen Jeremy. He said, "He was yelling about Norway, then he started what I would call Sieg Healing, but he called it a Viking salute." During the video, Micah was trying to defuse the situation. He was dressed up as a clown and was juggling as Jeremy went on a racist diatribe and used the N-word several times. The other person you hear arguing with Jeremy in the recording I'm about to play isn't Micah, but another protester.
Don't use the N-word, man.
That's a real fucking
N-word. Yeah, don't use the N-word. That's not appropriate.
Racist piece of shit. All right,
buddy. So what? Is it over yet? You want to provoke it? Is that right?
I was just wondering.
I don't see any of the people that wanted to demask because I'm being separated instead of being able to have freedom of movement and talk to you guys and them. I'm being separated by the police.
My freedom of movement is now a bridge because the police are here. All right? I don't got nothing against any of you guys. I don't care if you call me a Nazi or nothing. It's a joke. It's a joke. I'm a nihilist.
He next spoke about the day of the stabbing. He said it appeared as though Jeremy was shouting at Destiny and Walia, and he could see that they were just young girls. He said he took his headphones off and walked towards Jeremy, telling him to shut up and telling him he couldn't yell at kids like that. Moments later, Jeremy slapped Leeshan's phone out of his hand, and Micah said he wanted to help him defend himself. Micah said that as a child, he had been bullied because of his autism, and he knew what it looked like before somebody is about to hurt somebody else. He said that Talishan looked like a really friendly person, and he didn't want to see him get hurt.
When I looked, and what I saw initially was this tall, spindly man with curly red hair. I remember glasses, don't ask me why. White dress shirt and beige slacks. What I saw was somebody that had probably never been in an altercation in their life, better yet a full-on fist fight with somebody that is screaming on a train. And what I could immediately notice was a combination of things. Number one, the man was surprised. So right off the bat, this was shocking to him.
The man was surprised. That's Talesian.
Yes, Talesian was surprised.
Appeared surprised?
Yes. The gentleman did not look prepared to handle a violent altercation.
Why did you think a violent altercation was imminent?
Because I have been, I guess for lack of a better term, victim of enough violence that I know what it looks like before somebody hurts somebody else. I remember getting up in between them. I think I tried to say something. I don't believe I got to saying it because the first thing that ended up happening was that I was pushed rather hard against, there's a rubber section in the train that allows it to bend, and I was pushed towards that. The next thing that I remember happening was me stepping up, and I don't remember if I said something. I stepped back forward to reassert myself in the space I previously was in. I believe Jeremy, at the time, I thought he was going to grab Talesian to hit him in the face, but it could have also been a push. And it was at that point that I then grabbed him by the collar and the back of the his right, my left, of the shoulder of his shirt, and I began to move him away.
Now, did you know at that point, actually prior to that point, that Jeremy Christian had pulled a knife out of his pocket and was holding it in one hand?
No.
Could you see that knife?
No, I was paying attention to his face, unfortunately.
What were you saying when you grabbed him, moved him away from Talesian?
I think I was saying, get the fuck off the train, go on and get.
He said he pushed Jeremy two more times before he was stabbed in the neck.
What did you do, physically?
I pushed him again.
And
closer, hopefully, towards the door.
How did he respond?
He responded by stabbing me in the throat.
Say it again?
He responded by stabbing me in the throat.
All right. Did you see that coming?
Not at all. In fact, originally, I thought he punched me.
At first, Micah thought that he had simply been punched, and he put his hand up to defend himself. It was at this moment that he noticed that there was blood on his hands and all across his shirt.
Where I thought he had punched me, and I was getting ready to put my hands up to guard for another one, and then I noticed there was blood on my fingers. And I was like, that's odd. And then I realized there was blood on my shirt, a lot of it, and then I realized it was coming out of my neck.
He told the courtroom, this wasn't about me feeding ego and protecting myself. I wanted to protect Leeshan. He spoke about his recovery and said that he has limited mobility in his neck, as well as a nerve problem. His jugular vein had been severed beyond repair and needed to be closed on the left side of his body. The stab wound had also chipped off a portion of his jawbone. Under cross-examination, Defence Smith asked Micah if he thought his response to Jeremy's rants were appropriate and was asked why he thought it was appropriate to get involved. He said, because whether or not something's appropriate, if it's right, you should do it. Defense Smith criticized Micah for using harsh language and raising his voice at Jeremy. After cross-examination, the prosecution would counter the defense's idea that Micah acted out of uncontrolled anger. Micah explained that when Jeremy and Talishan stood face to face, he was worried that Jeremy was going to throw Talishan between some seats, and then others wouldn't be able to intervene or pull Jeremy away. He said that if Jeremy wanted to put Talishan in a situation where he couldn't be helped, then he could have done that with relative ease and speed. That's why he put himself into the situation, because he was used to dealing with assaults. Prosecutor Reese asked, "What happened instead?" And Micah replied, "He died. He got hurt. I was wrong. I couldn't save him. I really wanted to and couldn't. I just wasn't strong enough." There would be some extremely graphic testimony regarding the injuries that Ricky and Talishan had sustained. Dr. Karen Gunson had conducted the autopsies. She said that Ricky had been stabbed 3 times, one on his right neck, one on his left cheek, and one on his left neck. The stab wound to the left of his neck had been fatal. She said that he bled to death on the floor of the train, adding that the wounds would have been very complicated to reach and very difficult to treat by a doctor. Talishan had been stabbed 4 times, and it was a stab wound to the left of his neck which caused death. The 1-inch stab wound hit his carotid artery and caused him to bleed profusely. He had also been stabbed 2 times in the neck and head area and had a defensive wound to his hand. Testimony would then be presented in regards to Jeremy's actions and statements following the murders. Detective Michelle Michaels, a Portland Police Bureau detective, would testify that she had interviewed Jeremy in a holding cell the night of the stabbings.
The other detectives told me, and I could hear actually when I came on the floor, he was yelling, he was banging against the door, kicking the door. I think he was saying something about having been in there and in handcuffs. And I said, "Well, you know, you actually exhibited some violent behavior. I don't know how you're going to react." And when I said that, he made a statement. He said, "What do you think when somebody assaults me on the max? They get stabbed in the fucking neck. You don't fucking touch me, all right? That's what happens. I'm a patriot, okay? You put your hands on me, you abridge my freedom of movement, you assault me, you die, okay? That's called America, all right? I've got freedom of speech. I got freedom of movement. My arm goes in their neck, okay? They fucked up. They died, okay? I hope they died. I get manslaughter, okay? Fuck you. Touch me. They die. Oops. Sorry. I bet that kid's wishing he hadn't touched me now. Huh? 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 I bet he's going, I fucked up. Oh, he fucked up. Oh, he fucked up."
By this point, she was already aware of the earlier attack on Demetria. Jeremy had told Detective Michaels, "If the fucking fair inspector wasn't around, I would have stabbed her." Then 2 days after the stabbings, she interviewed him again and he said, "I can't explain. There's no way I can explain. They would have been alive if they had just kept their hands to themselves, or gotten off the train, or allowed me to have my free speech. Only because they started getting violent with me, they signed their own death warrant. I don't feel one bit remorseful about that." She then testified about the surveillance footage from before the stabbings had occurred, and even before the altercation had occurred. She said that as Sean can be seen moving towards Destiny and Walia, Jeremy made a slicing motion across his neck. She then spoke about Jeremy's actions during the confrontation. She noted that he slapped Talishan's phone out of his hand and pushed him. Nobody had touched Jeremy at this point, but he can be seen on surveillance lifting out the knife and holding it in his hand, urging them to do something.
Yeah, so it shows me a few things. Let's just talk about the speed at which things happen. It's incredibly fast. And then when you see the actions of the individuals, I could see, first of all, Talishan Nampamecha walking up to him. Mr. Mitchell has his phone in his hand, and he just sits down next to Mr. Christian. Mr. Christian reaches over, grabs the phone, throws it down. So for me, that's the first sort of physical action, taking something from him and doing that. Mr. Nakameche stands up. About that time is when the train's coming in, you'll see him kind of reach and grab that stability bar as well. Mr. Christian also stands up, and as he does so, he is saying, you know, do something, bitch, at Mr. Nakameche. Mr. Nakameche says something about I don't know what Mr. Nakameche says. He says something. Mr. Jeremy Christian, in response, says, fuck your phone. At this point in time, Mr. Michael Fletcher is walking up. Mr. Christian is sort of saying things to him about do something, and that's when that push happens. The first one, Jeremy Christian to Michael Fletcher. And at that point, you see those shorts kind of flare out. Mr. Michael Fletcher walks back up. So a note to me is he doesn't do anything. He walks back over. Felicia Nakameche and Jeremy have another exchange. And at that point, Jeremy Christian kind of pushes Felicia Nakameche right sort of up in here and pushes him backwards. I think he says, shut the fuck up, and pushes him backwards. So again, what I'm noting on all of this is no one has touched him at this point. Yet he has pushed Michael Fletcher, he has pushed Felicia Nakameche, and in between those two things, he got the knife out of his pocket. And all the while saying, do something, do something.
It was after Micah pushed Jeremy away from them that he moved the knife into his right hand and started stabbing. During the testimony, Jeremy started to shake his head before stating, she's lying. While the defense tried to contend that Jeremy had acted in self-defense, the video showed that neither Talishan or Ricky had touched Jeremy during the confrontation. Detective Michaels testified that Talishan had been looking at his mobile phone when Michael was stabbed and looked up just as he was stabbed in the neck, face and hand. She said that the entire time, Talishan was holding his phone in one hand and a food container in the other. She said, it indicated to me that Talishan never did anything in being able to defend himself. There wasn't anything he tried to do to rectify the situation. He was defenseless. Detective Michaels then noted that Ricky was looking down, not at Jeremy. He was standing still with one hand gripping a bar that was attached to the MAX train. His other hand was down by his side. Prosecutors would then play out a phone call between Jeremy and a friend from behind bars, which took place 7 months after the murder. Jeremy said he got into an altercation with Talishan because he had stuck a mobile phone in his face. He then mocked Micah, calling him a wannabe social justice warrior who was having an autistic tantrum. The defense would now present their own case. They had hired a use of force consultant, Stephen Yerger, who offered a strikingly different interpretation of the events leading up to the stabbings. Stephen suggested that Micah was aggressive and confrontational and invaded Jeremy's personal space by moving within 6 to 8 feet of him. He didn't mention the fact that Jeremy had first of all been the one to stand up and get in the face of Talishan, slap his phone out of his hand and then push him. He stated, I would point out what Mr. Fletcher did was very inflammatory and was basically pouring gasoline on the fire. Under cross-examination, Stephen seemed perplexed when prosecutor Jeff Howes asked him to define who the fire was that he was referring to.
When you use the analogy gasoline on a fire, Mr. Christian's the fire in that analogy, is that right?
He was pretty agitated.
So Mr. Christian's the fire in that analogy, is that right?
No.
No, so when you use the analogy throwing gasoline on a fire, and you used it to say that someone like Michael Fletcher would be throwing gasoline on a fire in his actions. Who's the fire? Where's the fire? What's the fire in that analogy? Do you understand what I mean by
yeah,
analogy?
Yeah, I do understand your analogy.
So what's the fire?
So when you approach somebody that's agitated in the manner that Mr. Fletcher did, I guess you could refer that to as potentially the fire, but that's potentially. It becomes the fire when you escalate that situation like Mr. Fletcher did.
So just playing out the analogy, if I throw gasoline on the ground when there's no source of ignition, that's not a fire, right?
Correct.
But if I throw gasoline on an already burning fire, then it makes it bigger. Isn't that the purpose of that analogy that you used to describe this situation? Yes or no?
He repeatedly referred to Micah, Talishan, and Ricky as the aggressors or threats, but didn't once refer to Jeremy as such. Prosecutor House would ask if it made a difference that Talishan's hands were full when Jeremy stabbed him, to which he replied that it was irrelevant. Another expert hired by the defense, Dr. Glenna Andrews, would testify that she had diagnosed Jeremy with autism spectrum disorder. When she was asked if the 11 to 12 seconds it took Jeremy to stab three people was enough for him to process the decision he made, she replied, "No, he's not a multitasker. He can't think of two things at the same time, and he can't do two things at the same time." Forensic psychologist Timothy Durning would testify that emotional control is often one issue that people with autism have. Under cross-examination, prosecutor Reese asked, "Most people with autism spectrum disorder don't commit crimes," to which Dr. Durning replied, "Yes." He would also question whether Jeremy actually had autism. His mother had said that he hadn't been diagnosed and there was nothing in his childhood to indicate he had autism. He said, "In your report, you wrote that autism spectrum disorder doesn't happen all of a sudden. You don't get it when you turn 30. To which Mr. Durning replied, "Correct." In fact, the prosecution would call on a rebuttal witness. Dr. Alan Newman testified that he personally did not believe that Jeremy had reached the criteria for autism. The defense tried to claim that Jeremy had cognitive deficits and struggled with the ability to develop a plan. However, the prosecution would then play the video of Jeremy taken less than 24 hours earlier on another MAX train, wherein he said he wanted to stab the train operator and said he was going to stab unspecified people. The prosecution said that this footage directly rebutted the defense's claims and gave a clear snapshot into Jeremy's mind. After all of the evidence was presented, it was time for closing arguments. Prosecutor Howe said that the argument Jeremy was using self-defense didn't hold up. Under Oregon law, you are justified in using physical force if you think that a person is committing or attempting to commit a felony by using physical force. The physical force you respond with would have to be what an individual reasonably believes is necessary. He said, "A reasonable person wouldn't have killed two people instantly. There is no rationalization to lead someone to believe what Jeremy did is an appropriate response." He reiterated that Jeremy was the provocateur in the incident, being the first to use physical force and yelling, "Do something, bitch." During the defense's closing arguments, attorney Greg Scholl said that Jeremy felt as though he had been cornered and put much of the blame on Micah. The jury would deliberate for a day and a half before reaching a unanimous decision. They found Jeremy Christian guilty on all charges. 2 of first-degree murder, attempted murder in the first degree, assault in the first degree, 3 of intimidation in the second degree, 2 unlawful use of a weapon, and menacing. The decision brought immense relief and a sense of justice to those who had been impacted by the tragedy. Outside of court, Demetrius said, "This is just a small defeat, but it lets people like Jeremy Joseph Christian know that you're not going to get away with it, that we do have people who care about all of us. Because black lives do matter. The people that were killed, they did that out of love and protection." The sentencing phase would be held in June. Victims and family members were allowed to provide victim impact statements. The first to read aloud was Demetria. During one portion of her statement, she said that far too often, black women are not believed. The police had wasted time questioning her, which allowed Jeremy to flee from the scene after he had verbally and physically assaulted her.
"I blame the system for creating and facilitating people like Jeremy And then we, the community, have to deal with them. In my case, the white supremacist got special treatment from the police. The police officer Gaffney believed the assault was made by the assailant. He didn't believe me or the two Chinese supervisors. The police captured, not killed, a racist white supremacist known to the police, holding the bloody knife he attacked and killed people with while drinking wine from his Gatorade bottle.
Unsurprisingly, Jeremy once again had an outburst directed at Demetria.
And to Mr. Jeremy Christian, you are a waste of breath. And when you die and go to hell, I hope you rot.
See you there, bitch.
Yeah, hey.
Go back to Tennessee,
no,
too.
You, what do I tell
go
you?
Go back to Tennessee, too. You can, we don't want you here. Bye. All your race baiting bullshit. Bye. You ain't gonna be mayor either, bitch.
As you can hear, at some point, Jeremy told Demetria that he should have killed her too. As he unleashed his attack, he stood up and started trying to square up to Demetria, who's on the witness stand. Others in attendance described how their lives had been forever changed. Many suffered nightmares in the aftermath, and some suffered from PTSD. Micah said he always had trouble sleeping, but added that now he faced more difficulties since he was almost murdered.
Even before everything started, I'd never been one that was good at sleeping. It's never been my forte. You blame it on what I'd like, but it's the truth. Now, the first thing that I noticed after the stabbing occurred was that I could sleep. It was weird. It was strange. The difficulty with it was that the sleep came with nightmares in perpetual forms. I would dream of sitting in a metal tunnel and slowly filling up with blood until I was drowning in it. See, I've changed a lot from all of this. Went from somebody that was trying to finish off a degree, who had just gotten done attempting to join the military, and in the face of being denied from that, attempted to actually finish off a college degree. I went from that to somebody that was trying to heal. I was failing miserably at it. And to be very frank with you, if it was not for a program that centered on anonymity and showed me how to have a spiritual experience through a series of steps, I wouldn't have been able to crawl out of the hole that was my life. And I still am stuck in that same hole. There is not a room in this world that I can enter without at least scanning it first to decide who the person is that is most likely to hurt me, how close by they are, attempting the calculations, how many steps would it take them to get to me? What kind of weapons do they have? Let me look at your pockets. What are the bulges in it? Is it long? Is it square? Is it L-shaped? If it's L-shaped, how quickly can I get behind cover? If it's something long, how quickly can I get far enough away from you that you can't reach me with whatever that object is? I basically spend the first 30 seconds of every event and area that I enter trying to figure out how easily I can die.
He said that when he enters a room with new people, he spends the first 30 seconds assessing who might try and kill him and checks for any bulges in their pockets which could be hidden weapons. Many stressed the need for systemic change in a world that doesn't want to own up to the circumstances that allowed somebody like Jeremy to act on his beliefs unfettered. Sean Ford said that society needed to work harder to eradicate racism. Before being handed a sentence, Jeremy was allowed to provide a statement. After his outburst, he had been sent to another room and was watching via video link. He refused to take responsibility for his actions.
I've been brought up in Portland, Oregon. I went to the blackest high school in Oregon. Where I'm from, we defend ourselves. Where I was brought up in North Portland, we defend ourselves. Where I was brought up in Oregon State Penitentiary, we defend ourselves. I did not commit an act of violence against anyone I'm educating. I shut up two people who confronted me while I was sitting in my seat. And I said, what are you going to do? We're going to fight, but I'm not backing down. That's what happened. They wanted to fight. Maybe not Tilly, maybe not Ricky Best, but they involved themselves in the situation. Sadly, they have died. And I do regret that two people died, but I do not regret my actions that led to their death. This is a standard Brown state, and I stood by Brown. And to my pleasure personally, I hold no ill will. You chose violence. I chose violence. People died. You survived. I understand your feelings of guilt. You should apologize to the families, not for not being there, but for being the main contributor of their deaths. Once you accept that, feel free to write me in prison. I don't know what will get you. That's my statement.
He did, however, admit that Ricky hadn't done a thing but stand near him when he stabbed him. He said that he simply assessed Ricky as a threat, and he ended up collateral damage. Jeremy Christian would ultimately be sentenced to life in prison, without the possibility of parole.
I was very scared that I was not going to see any of the people I love again, and I am very fortunate to have the opportunity to get to still be in their lives. The best thing we can do as a community is to rally behind those families that lost their loved ones and do whatever we can to take care of them in this time of immense trial and difficulty. None of this is in any way their fault, and that the world is just a very cruel place sometimes. I'm just some kid from Portland that did the right thing. It's not a big deal. I come from a family and a background of people that help others. And that's what I did. I saw that there was help that was needed, and I tried to help. We need to remember that this is supposed to be a city where people can be safe, where children can play, where laughter can grow, and where love can take roots in the soil. And it's going to take us standing together as a community if we want that to be the Portland we live in.
The idea of free speech should not be warped into the idea that white supremacy, racism, and xenophobia is a legitimate ideology which falls under the umbrella of free speech and is worthy of discussion as equality. While free speech certainly is a fundamental human right, all speech is not of equal value, especially when it comes to making blatant threats against teenage girls, or anybody for that matter, with a knife in your pocket. In the space of just 11 short seconds, two men lost their lives standing up against hatred, while a third was horrifically wounded and many others left traumatized. Jeremy Christian's actions that day sounded the alarm about the violence that can follow hate speech. However, the attack also brought out the very best in people. The actions of the heroes on that train that afternoon conveyed a powerful message that resonated across the world: that hatred and bigotry is not accepted. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. I'd like to say a big, massive thank you to my amazing new Patreon supporters, Anna Kildrew on Instagram, Desiree, Camilla, and Jenny. If you'd like to support the show on Patreon, the link is in the show notes. In return for your support, you get exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, which aren't on the regular podcast platforms, merch, which includes t-shirts, stickers, pins, key rings, fridge magnets, and more, as well as ad-free and early release episodes, behind the scenes including bonus audio and case files, and much, much more. Could I also ask a massive favour, and ask that if you enjoy Morbidology, please consider leaving me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Ratings and reviews are an easy way to support a show that you like, and I really love reading them. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And please stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing podcast, Rogue Darkness. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Witchcraft, the occult, extremist beliefs, murder. Tune in to Rogue Darkness each Friday and join host Raven as I uncover horrific crimes committed under the misconceptions and misunderstandings of witchcraft and other belief systems. I'll cover a wide range of crimes involving ritualistic killings and extremist beliefs to cult persuasion and supposed possession. Anything and everything that borders the line of horrifying. There's always three sides to a story. Side A, side B, and then the truth. Let's uncover the truth together and explore the darkness of mankind, one crime at a time. Available wherever you get your podcast fix, simply by searching Rogue Darkness.